Hello, Mabuhay. My name is Dr. Josephine Glazer. I'm a family physician from the Show Me State of Missouri. It is my joy and privilege to share the impact of CMA in my life. I was first introduced to Christian Medical Association by my anatomy lab partner over Mr. Smith's dead body. During the course of our dissection, she invited me to attend Bible study. I was spiritually revived in medical school through CMA. I saw and met exceptional, compassionate, humble, virtuous doctors, academics, ethicists in the field who discipled and mentored me. The commissions and ministries of CMA, like the Women Physicians in Christ, are an oasis for a female physician, wife, mother, caregiver, and follower of Jesus, like me. National conferences and missions conferences, like the Global Health Missions Conference, equipped, empowered, and mentored me in the art and science of faith and medicine integration and servant leadership. My physician husband and I attended a CMA marriage enrichment weekend with another couple a few years ago. We felt refreshed, renewed, and rekindled our commitment to our foundational marriage promise to be one in Christ. We believe, just as physicians and other healthcare professionals are required to maintain their continuing medical educations, married physicians ought to maintain their continuing marriage education. CMA matters deeply to me because I feel connected with Jesus, the head and the foundation of the church. Through the coordinated, transformative, eternal, life-giving work He's doing through CMA. I can't wait to hear Dr. Chubb's next podcast. Can you? So enjoy, and may God's peace be with you.
Well, Dr. Glazer, wait no longer, because we are back with CMDA Matters, the weekly podcast of the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. I'm your host, Dr. Mike Chupp, and today on the program, we will be talking with special guest, physician and bioethicist, Dr. Henry Williams from Nashville, Tennessee, and the Center for Bioethics and Culture. Well, we are very close to celebrating the birth of our Savior, Jesus Christ, on Christmas, and you might say that God designed, the Heavenly Father designed His Son, who knew no sin, to be made sin for us in order that we might receive the righteousness of God. Well, today we're going to talk about designer babies of a different kind and human flourishing in an age when gene editing has become readily accessible by scientists and researchers around the globe, which raises all sorts of ethical concerns and sounds alarm bells for mankind's future. Today I'm joined by my co-host, Dr. Jeff Barrows, who himself has a master's in bioethics. And he leads our CMDA bioethics and public policy efforts. I welcome you to listen in to our recent conversation with Dr. Henry Williams. Well, today my guest is Dr. Henry Williams, who received his medical degree from Vanderbilt University Medical School and completed his residency in internal medicine at the University of Minnesota. He has served as a general medical officer for the Indian Health Service, Navajo Reservation in Shiprock, New Mexico. He's also practiced general internal medicine at Chattanooga Internal Medicine Group from 1979 until the present time. He did go up to Chicago and got his master's in bioethics from Trinity International University in 2005, and actually has taught overseas bioethics in Belarus. In addition, he's provided medical care in Zambia, Haiti, Nicaragua, Honduras, and Ethiopia. He's currently the board chair for the Tennessee Center for Bioethics and Culture, where he contributed recently to a book review on the series of essays put into a book entitled Human Flourishing in an Age of Gene Editing. And that particular book review caught our eye here at CMDA, and that's why I've invited him today to be our guest and to talk about a book, not a Christian book, written by Perrins and Johnston, who are secular authors, but I think we have a lot we can learn from these editors who've put together this series of essays. And with me in the studio today is also a fellow bioethicist who joins Dr. Williams as a graduate from Trinity International University. Welcome to the program, Jeff Barrows.
Good to be with you, Mike.
Well, Dr. Williams, how long have you been chairman of the board of the Tennessee Center for Bioethics and Culture? And could you just tell us a little bit about the center and what it's all about?
Well, Dr. Joy Riley, I think her capstone project when she completed the MA degree in bioethics at Trinity decided that she wanted to start something for the state of Tennessee. And she looked at Jennifer Lahl and what she had done in California when she did something similar. So I had met Joy at one of the conferences. I think she finished a little bit different time than I did, but I've been on the board with her for well over 10 years, I guess. She is the executive director of the center, and she does a lot of speaking and blogging and writes a lot of op-eds and has had a good impact, especially this past year.
Well, you served as a general medical officer in the Indian Health Service. Your background is in internal medicine. Tell us about how you got interested in bioethics and why you pursued a master's in bioethics.
When I went into medicine, I thought about seminary when I was in college too, but I was really more drawn to medicine. But I was really drawn to the human aspects and the moral aspects of what would happen as a doctor. I didn't have many mentors early on, but I met Sid McCauley, who was the regional director at that time in Atlanta, Decatur, Georgia, and he encouraged me to become a member as a medical student, and always had an interest in medical ethics. And I read a couple of essays by Dr. Edmund Pellegrino, which further stimulated my thinking along that line. And then I went to the CMDA offered an introductory course at their, I think it was in San Antonio when you had one of the national conventions was down there. That really excited me, and I decided to sign on for the whole MA program after that.
You wrote a book review of the book Human Flourishing in an Age of Gene Editing. Why did you decide to take the time and to write a review on this particular book, Dr. Williams?
Dr. Riley handed me the book at one of our board meetings and said, here, would you like to take a look at this book? It's something that came here in, and it looks interesting. And I said, well, sure. And I read it, and I was just fascinated by it. It is a series of essays by secular bioethicists who are in different centers, Vanderbilt, UC San Diego. A lot of them are connected with the Hastings Center, which is a preeminent secular bioethics think tank. But the essays were bringing up cautionary concerns about genetic engineering and about CRISPR in particular, because it's proliferated so much in the last several years. I was impressed by the cautionary statements that many of these folks made. And I think the central essay for me was the one by John Evans from the Center for Practical Ethics in UC San Diego. Dr. Evans talks about how bioethics in a secular way developed in the 70s by these guys who came up with this four-prong framework of principles. They said, we got to find some kind of common morality that we can hang our hats on to set up ethical guidelines. So they said, well, it's going to be beneficence, it's going to be non-maleficence, doing no harm, autonomy, and justice. So that was great up to a point. That helped set the stage for developing informed consent guidelines, research guidelines, and a number of other things, some end-of-life approaches. But John Evans in his essay talks about how this is really a thin form of bioethics. It is a very thin way to hang your hat on. It doesn't talk about human dignity. It doesn't talk about respect for handicapped people. It doesn't talk about really what's going to make human beings really flourish. And so we need all of these other things brought in, virtue ethics and all these other things. So he said we need a thicker type of bioethics, which means we need public input. We need more concern about these other things. And so that's one sort of set of things that came out of the book. The other thing was just the different people talking about, you know, what does enhancement mean? And what does it mean to think about this in the light of people who are handicapped? Should we be trying to fix people, or should we be trying to help people grow with the conditions that they have? And it's just, there's a whole mindset in the culture that's going a certain way. And these guys, I thought, put up very helpful roadblocks or caution signs to say, we need to think about this in some other ways.
Well, Dr. Williams, before we get a little deeper into the bioethics of gene editing, I think it might be helpful for those in our audience, healthcare professionals that don't deal with CRISPR on a regular basis and maybe have a lot of background, if you could just give us a little bit of an overview of what CRISPR is and how it's changed the landscape of genetic engineering.
Okay, so CRISPR, it's a biological system that was discovered in bacteria. And in 2012, these hardworking ladies, Jennifer Doudna and Emmanuel Charpentier, were working on this thing, and they found that they could take an enzyme called Cas9, C-A-S-9, which acts as a pair of scissors that can cut DNA. They attach that to a piece of messenger RNA that's made from an area of interest in the genome, and that mRNA will take the enzyme to an area of DNA of interest and cut it. And they can snip out a piece and replace it or fix it or regulate it. At any rate, that's a poor man's way of describing the science. But what's happened is it has made genetic engineering much cheaper, much more precise, and much faster. And so there has been a proliferation of labs, apparently, across the world using this thing. CRISPR has been used in many ways already in very beneficial ways. It's been used in agriculture. They're using it to make better tomatoes, better plants, crops resistant to disease, all kinds of things like that. They're researching it in animals. There's also a lot of potential to help people by doing somatic cell engineering with CRISPR, modifying blood cells, for example, to help fix sickle cell anemia or hemophilia, or maybe certain eye diseases. So it's got a lot of potential to help in those sorts of ways. The problem is, or the more controversial part of it is, that it's going to be applied to germline cell engineering, which is fraught with many problems morally and practically. So it has opened up a whole new can of worms for bioethics.
Well, the authors of this book point out that human flourishing, there's a broad array of opinions on what equals flourishing for humans, and that having perfect genes does not guarantee flourishing. There's so many variables in our lives, and for parents to plan to have perfect children, they're going to need to be in a social environment to be able to thrive. What are some take-home lessons about flourishing from this particular textbook written by Eric Perrins and Josephine Johnston that you think our listeners would really need to be clued in terms of the future of this technology?
One of the things is the first essay in the book where these two ladies who are living with genetic handicaps talk about how they have been allowed to flourish, not in spite of, but almost because of or with their handicaps. Human flourishing in one way really involves not fixing somebody to be more enhanced or have better physical features or something or be a better athlete, but helping people live and grow with the situations they have. You can think about how some people who have flourished in tremendous ways almost because of problems, like think of Fanny Crosby, who was blind. Would we have that many hymns if she had not been blind? Right. Would we have as many wheelchairs for the world if Johnny Erickson Tata had not had her accident? There are many things that you can think about there. One of the essays talks about the givenness of people, accepting people as they are, and not only accepting our children or people as they are, but cherishing folks. We have a 3-year-old grandson with about 6 different medical problems. He has asthma, terrible skin, eczema. He's got a seizure disorder and delayed speech and a few other things. But he's a beautiful kid, and we love him. And I don't think we would want, we can't imagine him being anybody but who he is. You know, he's somebody who makes us want to reach out and love and do things for him. So that's one thing, too. And, you know, I think part of it, flourishing, too, is not listening to the science, the mechanistic, reductionistic approach that science is taking. You know, we've got this technology. We got to do something with it. We need to know what people want. And that's part of the thicker bioethics discussion is getting out, listening to people and, you know, asking what helps them. Another thing I think is, I think I have to think biblically, and the verse that I don't want to miss quoting here today is 1 Corinthians 4, where it says, we hold this treasure in jars of clay in order to show that it is God that has the surpassing power and not us. So we're weak vessels, we're fragile vessels, we're created people in his image, but our mission is to hold and hold out the gospel and to recognize that God is the creator, not us. Mm-hmm. The book does have two theologically based essays, one from a Catholic point of view and one from a mainline Protestant point of view. Those essays are very worth reading as well, pointing out some theological basis for figuring out flourishing.
Well, Dr. Williams, did any of these essays begin to look at, as gene editing becomes more and more prevalent, it's going to cause a lot of different debates in our society? And I'm kind of curious as to whether any of the essays might be helpful to us as Christian healthcare professionals to provide us the arguments that we might make, for instance, against embryonic gene type of editing versus the somatic cell, as you talked about.
To be honest with you, this book is not written from a Christian perspective. It's secular bioethicists. They really don't address the moral implications of embryonic stem cell research very much. Many of the essays are written from a humanistic point of view, you could say, but I think they have something to offer to us to think about bioethics and think about flourishing. There is a good essay in here on human dignity, though, which is very important to read, and I think that's a very central one, talking about, they will not use the phrase sanctity of human life, but they talk about the importance of human dignity and how that needs to be recognized, and how Leon Cass, with his counsel under President Bush, developed this in a very helpful way in the series of essays that they produced. So that's something that's very central in the book and very helpful to us as Christians, I think.
Our sister international organization, the International Christian Medical and Dental Association, run by Dr. Peter Saunders, they have a weekly webinar series. And I watched one just actually from October, all about the bioethics of genetic engineering. Dr. Trevor Stammers from the UK gave that talk. And one of the fascinating concepts that I think is a little bit controversial that Trevor brought up was the idea that germ cell line change, it creates a new individual. I found that a little bit hard to understand and to follow, that we have only one journey through life, Trevor mentioned, and that a somatic change is just like taking, for me as a surgeon, removing a cancer, and that same individual carries on throughout life, but that a germline change actually in some ways creates a new individual. I'd be interested in your response to that perspective.
Yeah, well, I think that's, you know, somebody has put it this way, designing designer humans or genetic engineering to change the genome is basically humans taking charge of our own instruction books. And it's also somebody else determining what an individual is going to be like by this other person's preferences. The thing is that it will cause effects that will not be recognized for many years until the individual comes of age. It will be also transmitted to other generations. There's no informed consent there. So it's fraught with many problems.
Well, Dr. Williams, I have a question for you. My background is OBGYN. I'm kind of curious if you have become familiar how all of this gene editing is going to impact prenatal testing. And if so, how would you advise OBGYNs, young OBGYNs, in terms of counseling their pregnant patients?
Well, that's a great question. And I asked Dr. Joy Riley, my colleague, this question, and her husband happens to be an OBGYN practicing physician. So he was very helpful in this regard. You know, I was saying to Joy, is there a place for doing genetic testing? Is that something we really ought to be doing or considering? The thing is that there are three purposes for doing genetic tests. One would be some people will look at the possibility of a defect that they would want to use to terminate a pregnancy, and that would not be acceptable to us. There are two other reasons. One is to enable medical or surgical treatment, possibly before birth or shortly after birth. One example there is spina bifida. You can look for the possibility of that problem by getting an elevated alpha-fetoprotein level and an amniotic fluid. The other thing that Dr. Riley's husband, Lewis, said was that it allows parents time to prepare for a disabled baby. People may need the opportunity to prepare financially and emotionally and practically for what's coming. So it may be reasonable to do genetic testing before birth for that reason. I think it has to be taken, undergone with a lot of caution and probably with some counseling before going into it.
As I read through some of their chapters and essays and watched the ICMDA webinar from last month, there was a reference to comparing the motivation back in Genesis of those who engineered and started building the Tower of Babel with now engineering with genetics. And as it says in Genesis, those who were building that tower, let's make a name for ourselves. And certainly this, the Chinese scientist who was the first one to do gene editing on some twins that had a predisposition whose father had HIV/AIDS, the hubris of thinking that we can make for ourselves a perfect, more perfect human being made in our image of what is perfect. How do you see this technology with man's pride being taken in directions that would be abused? Maybe summarize for us the concerns that you have as you've been observing this technology over the last several years.
You know, I think it's interesting to look at some of the statements that have been made by some of these scientists. There was a big committee appointed in 2015 to advise government about how we should proceed with genetic engineering. And if you read some of the people's statements, like one comment was that there are going to be, we're going to have to go slowly about genetic engineering, but we need to press on and we need to do it because it's our destiny. We have a duty to use fetal tissue for research and therapy, one of the co-chair of the committee said. Enhancement is seen by a lot of people as therapy rather than just they're trying to redefine it that way. One of the comments was that prohibitions against enhancement technologies are at most going to be containment initiatives or speed bumps. We want to press on with this. And Francis Collins has brought up several cautions to think about or points to think about why we need to go slowly. And we've alluded to some of them, but it does have to, we have to realize that there will be unequal access due to socioeconomic factors. There will be haves and have-nots. There will be wealthy people directing lots of money into this. There will be commercial pressure to do genetic testing and genetic engineering because it's going to be catching on in the culture. And there will be clever advertising and so forth that will promote it. One of the big things is that the genetic engineering takes an attitude towards children of commodification. It will have a tendency to see our offspring as objects to be altered to suit a preference or agenda, making people through somebody else's priorities. So, those are a lot of big concerns, besides the fact that there are these unexpected mutations, off-target effects, lack of consent from future generations, and so on.
What is the risk from all of this research into genetic engineering of permanently damaging the human genome? I have to imagine there is some risk. Is it very high? Has anybody looked at trying to get a number around that? Has Francis Collins even spoken to that particular issue?
Well, there are huge risks potentially. But, I think that the CRISPR technology and genetic engineering is still in a way in its infancy, I suppose. There are people thinking about it, tinkering with it. There are people that are going off the rails, like Dr. He Jiankiu in China, who allowed those babies to be born that had genetic modification. Who knows what's going to happen to those kids as they grow up? There's all kinds of risk that can't be foreseen. Now, they talk about CRISPR as being precise and efficient and all that, besides being quick and cheap. But, I don't think anybody knows what snipping out a piece of DNA is going to do down the road to many of these situations, especially if they involve embryos and children. But the actual risk, how can you quantitate it? I don't know if we can say.
What principles would you suggest to us, Dr. Williams, can guide us as we evaluate one after another intervention using this CRISPR-Cas9 technology and let's not even talk about an enhancement, but let's just talk about some sort of intervention to help make life better. Just like we in healthcare, we're trying to heal disease, ease pain and suffering. What guidelines would you give us?
Well, I think it's good to consider the traditional ends of medicine, as Dr. Pellegrino used to talk about. He said that so much of this enhancement thing, and he wrote this about this several years ago, but he said that enhancement goes beyond the ends of medicine that they have traditionally been held. And I think we need to think about what are the traditional ends of medicine. I think we need to think about what would really bring about human flourishing. Is enhancement really something we want to do? But I think we also just need to think about bright lines. That's something we'd like to talk about at the center in Tennessee here, about there are certain bright lines that we probably shouldn't be crossing. And some people are trying to cross, trying to push that envelope. So much of the time, you know, many of these experiments involve experimenting with embryos. And scientists are itching to get their hands on more embryos to do research. All of this is tied in with embryonic stem cell research and working on and manipulation. They're going to manipulate embryos. They're going to destroy embryos. For us, I think that's a bright line that we probably don't want to cross. So that's a particular guideline. I think we need to listen to people who have spoken wisely about these sort of things. And I have this quote here from C.S. Lewis, you know, The Abolition of Man, thinking about what he wrote many years ago. The power of man to make himself what he pleases means the power of some men to make other men what they please. We will at last get a race of conditioners who can really cut out all posterity in what shape they please.
Wow. That's a good way for us to end this program today. Thank you for taking time out today, Dr. Williams, to enlighten us on this book. And thank you for your leadership. And God bless you in the coming days as you have an influence over medicine and genetic engineering.
Blessings on you as well. I'm so thankful for what you're doing. I've enjoyed your podcast very much. I've been really getting addicted to them here. So keep it up. Thank you for what you're doing up there.
You've become my new best friend, Dr. Williams. Well, if you'd like to learn more about the ethics of gene editing, our international affiliate, ICMDA, hosted an excellent webinar on this topic on October 1st, which I referred to in the interview with Dr. Williams. You can access the recorded webinar by just typing into your browser, ICMDA Gene Editing, and the YouTube video by Dr. Trevor Stammers will come up. We will also include the link for that presentation in our show notes. Well, you can get a copy of the book we were discussing today entitled Human Flourishing in an Age of Gene Editing on Amazon, as well as another great book on the topics of gene editing and transhumanism entitled Humans 2.0 by Dr. Fuzz Rana. He was also my guest on CMDA Matters earlier this year. You know, science just can't make moral decisions for us. Having factual information is not enough to determine right from wrong. With technology rapidly changing, we need a solid framework with which to consider how to use technology in a way that honors God and promotes human flourishing that we've been discussing today. Why the Church Needs Bioethics, A Guide to Wise Engagement with Life's Challenges, is by Dr. John Kilner. It equips Christians to take part in the discussion of bioethical issues, being salt and light and defending the vulnerable. You can find this book and many others at cmda.org/store, or just call us and order the book at 888-230-2637. Frequently, I'd like to give you an update from Washington, D.C., and our government relations director, Mr. Jonathan Embody, has been meeting weekly in a conference call with top U.S. health officials who are spearheading the current drive to protect us as Americans, and really those around the globe, from the pandemic through vaccination. Jonathan met recently with Dr. Anthony Fauci of the NIH, as well as Ambassador Dr. Deborah Birx of the White House Coronavirus Task Force, as well as Dr. Robert Redfield, Director of the CDC. And these officials explained to Jonathan and others the extremely thorough, independent, and transparent process that career scientists at FDA,
who are not political appointees or politicians what they apply to each vaccine candidate in the approval process. They also explained how the federal government will allocate vaccines to individual state governments based on their population. While CDC provides guidance, governors ultimately determine which citizens get priority. The CDC recently recommended prioritizing health professionals and the elderly in long-term care institutions for the first supply of vaccines that came out this week. Dr. Redfield of the CDC lamented during the meeting that up to a third or more of the American public still are questioning whether they should even take this vaccine. You know, once vaccines are FDA approved, it's very important that we let our patients know that while no vaccine is perfect, they can be confident to take a vaccine such as the Pfizer or Moderna vaccine, knowing that it has gone through this thorough, independent, and transparent process. Well, to learn more and get the latest updates that we receive from top government officials on vaccines and the pandemic response, just visit our Freedom to Care, that's Freedom Numeral 2 Care website at freedomtocare.org. Under the Issues tab, just click on Coronavirus. I also want to encourage you to read a commentary by our own Dr. Jeff Barrows and Jonathan Embody that was published in Public Discourse and entitled, Is Receiving the Pfizer-BioNTech COVID-19 Vaccine Ethical? You can just Google or Bing Barrows, B-A-R-R-O-W-S, and Public Discourse, and you'll find that article. Well, finally, we recently published, along with several other pro-life groups, a document entitled Physician Support for Ethical Vaccines, which you will find on cmda.org, our website. Just enter into the search box, Physician Support for Ethical Vaccines. Well, COVID-19 has wreaked havoc on mission sending agencies as well as our CMDA outreaches across the globe through our Global Health Outreach and Medical Education International Ministries. But GHO would like you to know that the Navajo Nation is requesting more registered nurses, licensed practical nurses, and certified nurse assistants through the various sites, including inpatient critical care, med-surg, and emergency room. They're asking for a 2-week minimum commitment, but of course, we'll welcome longer-term commitments. If you feel led to serve in this capacity, just go to cmda.org/GHO and click the big red button on the right to find a trip. Or you can just email gho@cmda.org. Well, as we approach 2021 and think about our national convention at the very end of April, I want to remind you that you can register for the VIE poster session because the deadline has been extended to February 28th. It's a great opportunity to present your research at the national convention, so be sure to sign up at cmda.org/VIE. There are scholarships that are available for our students to attend the national convention. For more information, go to cmda.org/PGScholarship. I don't want to forget, as we approach the end of 2020, to remind you about our very first 2021 virtual Remedy Conference being held January 9th and 10th. You can register and get more information about this conference at cmda.org/remedy. Our theme this year, Remedy, Bringing Hope and Healing to a World in Crisis. As I close our program today, I want to say thank you to all of you who have already responded so generously to the matching gift that one of our members graciously supplied to encourage all of us in our support for your CMDA. I am thrilled to share with you that as of today, we have received $84,625 toward the goal of matching $100,000, and we are within reach of our total goal before December 31st of $275,000. If you've had good intentions of helping CMDA claim this gift, Just go to cmda.org/give and take care of those intentions today. Well, that wraps it up for this week. We know that honoring God as supreme authority and creator of all life matters to you. Protecting the vulnerable and preserving the life God designed in the womb matters to us as well at CMDA, and CMDA matters. Thanks for listening, and have a blessed Advent season. We'll see you next week, God willing.
This podcast has been a production of the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. The opinions expressed by guests on this podcast are not necessarily endorsed by the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. CMDA is a nonpartisan organization that does not endorse political parties or candidates for public office. The views expressed on this podcast reflect judgments regarding principles and values held by CMDA and its members and are not intended to imply endorsement of any political party or candidate.